This is the Techno Buffet Podcast, episode number 662, recorded Wednesday, January 24th, 2024, in 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. You know, I realized that we may be one of the few podcasts that has a live theme music performed every week.
That's true.
I wonder if anybody else does that. I'm going to exclude music podcasts, but where it's possible. But at the very least, it is not a typical feature.
I would agree.
Yeah. You know, it's been a while since I did that on my harmonica. I should go find it. You know, change things up a bit.
Don't get too crazy.
No, crazy would be breaking out my harpsichord. Because I don't own a harpsichord, and that would definitely be crazy.
Oh, that would be crazy. Right.
So it's been another week.
A week has passed.
Yes. Did you do anything interesting or exciting during the course of your week?
Oh my God, dude. Okay. See, yes. Oh my God. And this was just today. So, check this out. I made a padlock, right? So I got a padlock.
You made a padlock?
Well, I bought a padlock. But I took out the core, the keying thing, and I re-keyed the lock so that it works for the key that opens my house and an additional key that's different, that does not open my house.
That's interesting.
I'm just super excited about it. I thought it was super cool. Well, I know it's not technology related, but.
No, how often do we talk about things that are sort of adjacent? I honestly think, rekeying yourself is very interesting.
Yeah, man, it was super easy. There's a Abus makes a padlock.
Yeah.
That it's called the Abus 83. And there's a slash that and a number that says how big it is. But the Abus 83 has a key core that you can pull out, and then it's super easy to rekey. And so I did, and I rekeyed it with master key shims so that I would have a key, and so it would basically respond to two keys. Super easy to do.
Well, I hope that your padlock serves you well. But
I hope so too.
It sounds like an interesting project to do. I did a few things. I built another ESP home sensor out of spare parts in my home to take to my office. I wanted to know since I make humidity, temperature, and other similar sensors.
Right.
I had this whole fight with them last year when I complained that the, one of those like inexpensive digital sensors that you put somewhere to see the temperature and the humidity.
Right. Yes.
With a little screen. I had one of those on my desk, and it was showing in the office that the humidity in there was like 16%. And I went.
That's not a lot.
Yeah. Well, I said.
It's like, that'll make your nose bleed, right?
Yeah. That was my complaint. I said, I'm coming to the office, and because of this, I'm having some discomfort. I said, well, can the building do anything? Because my employer rents, there's a landlord. A commercial property owner. So they went to the building and said, nope, they can't change anything. I said, well, can I bring in a humidifier? No. That might set off the smoke detector.
What?
I have to ask them because that was when I was at my old desk, and I have to look to see whether or not there's a smoke detector. They moved me so they could demolish my desk of 7 years to replace it with a couch for people to collaborate. They'd succeeded in demolishing my desk, but they have not yet apparently ordered the couch. So there's just empty space there now. But I have to see if there's a smoke detector worm. But essentially, that was sort of the problem. I said, can I bring like a little personal humidifier, put it on the desk in front of me, and it'll just, you know, moisten the air around me? And no.
Why would a humidifier set off a smoke alarm?
Don't look at me. I'm not going to set off. I'm not going to get in trouble and set off the smoke alarm. But I figured that I would want to monitor the, you know, how the humidity in the building is doing, specifically at my desk. So the reason I'm mentioning this is I set up an ESP home thing, and my question was, well, how do I get that data back to my house? And also, how do I do it in such a way that the people at my place of business will not feel like I'm putting a malicious device on the network?
Right.
Well, first of all, we have a guest network, so it's not like I'm going to put it on the corporate network. The guest network is isolated and firewalled, or so I'm told. I didn't set it up. But so I did that, and all it does is it takes the data and it sends it to my MQTT server in Newark.
Right.
For me to pick it up. So it's sitting here on the desk waiting for me to deliver it and see how this works. But it was an interesting thing because I looked at all of these different things that ESP Home could do. For example, I could have ESP Home now has a WireGuard VPN component.
Really? That's cool.
And the idea is if you want a sensor somewhere outside of your network to be able to broadcast. Now with this one, the challenge was that the MQTT server I have in Newark has an SSL certificate. And ESP Home by default doesn't do SSL for their certificates.
Okay.
In that component. But what they have a notation there about how you can do it, except I had to completely change what I was doing. So I have to essentially put the core certificate for the certificate authority into the configuration so that the device has it. And I had to essentially build the firmware with a different framework in order for that to work.
That's kind of crazy.
Yes, and apparently there's notation that support for that framework is experimental.
Well, good luck.
Yep. That reminds me, there's a warning here I forgot to do when I have to reprogram it before I bring it in because there's a notation. I just noticed it on the page when I brought it up to look at that whole certificate authority thing again. If you don't use the native API, you have to remove the API line from your ESP home configuration. Otherwise, it will reboot every 15 minutes. That's a good bit of advice.
Yes.
Note to self, do that right now before I forget. Not reprogram it, but just go into the code and take out the API line.
Well, it will assume that it can't get a hold of the...
Yeah. No, I'm saying it. I missed that line the first time I looked at the page. So I just saved it in the file for later. But anyway... So that was sort of interesting, and it made me think, where else could I put like a remote ESP Home's powered sensor outside of my home? Where do I want to monitor things? I came up with a few interesting ideas for that, assuming I get certain people to cooperate.
What about like a light sensor in your mailbox?
There's no power there.
Well, yeah, and you really need electricity for ESP Home, right?
Yeah,
which always not like if you had a Zigbee device.
I have plenty of Zigbee devices. In fact, I just got a new one in the mail.
Ooh.
Which I was going to mention. I have not opened it, but I wanted to try out another Third Reality product. Third Reality makes these reasonably good Zigbee products, and they're branching into Matter products. So they have what is effectively a smart nightlight, which include essentially it's a bunch of sensors plus a nightlight. And there's while that's not necessarily that impressive, there's a place in my house where is exactly what I would want.
Right.
Which is, and I've done it other ways using a smart plug, but I wanted to see what an integrated unit would look like. It's a little more expensive than I wanted to do, which is why I'm only trying one of them. not too expensive for me to consider buying it, but too expensive for me to litter the house with them. But
these are kind of cool. There's they have a variety of things.
Yeah, but their nightlight works perfectly for what I wanted under my counter. So I don't have under cabinet lighting. I don't really need it. But I want a light that when I turn off the lights in the room, turns on. And you may say, couldn't I do that with a simple light sensor? Doesn't work. The light sensor almost always, whenever there's something blocking it, just turns on when the lights in the room are on. So I'm doing all of this so that the light will not turn on when the lights in the ceiling are on, because I can hook them together using Home Assistant.
That nightlight's kind of cool.
I think so. I thought it was worth a try. And if you look what's actually in it from Third Reality, you saw that it doesn't just contain a light, but it contains several other pieces that are potentially useful. Let me get the specs on that. It unfortunately took 3 extra days to get here. It apparently got lost somewhere in Washington. But it has a motion sensor. It has the color nightlight, and it has an illumination sensor. So the nice thing is, since you're controlling it, it doesn't automatically do anything. All those sensors are fed into your Home Assistant instance or whatever Zigbee thing you're using. So I'm not just getting a little nightlight. I'm getting a little nightlight that adds multiple other sensors. And my nightlight is multicolor. As I said, the list price, there was a coupon that brought it down. But a nightlight for $30 is a little much for a nightlight. But I figured in one or two strategic places, it's probably worth it.
It is not super cheap.
Yeah, but it also acts as a repeater. And the part of the house I want to put it in is pretty far from my base. So it has a secondary advantage also. That it can extend the range of my network.
I'm going to add that to my wish list.
Okay. The other thing that I got that was ESP Home related was, I think I mentioned that I had been talking to somebody and gotten some advice where they had bought an air gradient sensor, and I had also bought one.
So my air who?
I mentioned the outdoor air quality monitor.
But why did you call it an air gradient?
That's the name of the company.
Oh.
Air gradient is the company. The thing is, they make really nice ones. And so I had this thing shipped from Thailand, and it happened to arrive. As did the one of the person who talked me into it, who talked me into something when they hadn't actually gotten theirs yet, which is always interesting, but they made a good argument. So I put this thing together and installed ESP Home on it, since it is running in essentially an ESP chip, and linked it into my ESP Home dashboard or my Home Assistant instance in a few minutes. So now hopefully I have a sensor that will not be problematic, because my old one kept dying because I did not properly weatherize it. And all the data is being fed in. So now I have new information. I now know how many volatile organic compounds are right outside my window.
But does that make you feel any better?
Well, I know if the number goes up, I probably shouldn't go and breathe them.
Okay.
Yep. Also, some of the other ones are pretty low. Right now, according to the device, let's see, where are we on our air quality at the moment? AQI, too many sensors here. Here we are. We're at 101. According to the formula that's inside the device, I have an independent formula that I use outside the device, but I had some problems with that, so I have to reconfigure it. I was working with the developer on it. But 101 is, I forget what the name is for that. So here we are. 101 is unhealthy for sensitive groups. It's actually exactly at the bottom of that. So it goes 0 to 50 is good, 51 to 100 is moderate, and 100 to 150 is unhealthy for sensitive groups. So it's a little dusty outside today. That's good to know. During the summer, when all those fires blew dust down from Canada, I was coughing outside, being out there for a few minutes. I guess I'm sensitive groups. Anyway, so other than that, just some general cleanup of things. Although I want to redo a whole bunch of my automations because I've discovered problems with them.
Really?
Problems with the logic.
Okay.
As in, I need to enhance them. For example, I have one that notified when a door sensor was tripped open. And when I upgraded the door lock, I put the same binary sensor that shows that the door lock unlocked or locked into that same automation. So the notification that comes to me if I'm here, if I'm not here and somebody unlocks the door is that the door was opened, whereas technically it was not opened, it was unlocked, which are two different things. So none of the things I want to do are that intensive. Also, some of my notifications are getting a bit annoying. And a few of them are not annoying enough. As in, the ones that are really important, I want to make more annoying so I don't miss them. And there are some that just keep going over and over again that are not at the right level of annoyance. So you don't want to create things so annoying that you ignore them, and you don't want to create things that are not annoying enough that you miss important things. For example, I now have my uptime monitoring that monitors all of my Home Assistant instances. And over the course of last week, actually the last day we recorded, because it would have been Thursday that I had it fixed, the one that's in upstate New York, I'm not going up there for a bit because it's cold and snowy and I don't have the need to.
Right.
But the internet up there went down. So I got a notification that the Home Assistant instance was down using my new uptime monitoring that I put in. But I didn't notice for a while because the it got buried in all the other notifications from Home Assistant that weren't important, which is the problem if you don't tune your notifications a little. But I ended up having to send somebody there to restart the internet for me, as in somebody who's local. Reminds me, I owe them a nice gift for doing that for me. But there we are. I don't want to change what my notifications do. Maybe I want to tweak it a bit and just look at, you know, maybe I could do it a little better. But I want to change it so that the notifications come in the right place and in the right way to make sure that I'm not missing something important. So for a few, the ones that come in through the uptime monitoring, which is outside of Home Assistant, even though there's an integration where instead of Home Assistant monitoring uptime, Home Assistant gets that information from the software I installed.
Right.
Since this, I essentially made it so that my notification software plays a special alert noise when one of the servers goes down for more than a few minutes. Instead of, right now, none of my notifications on my phone play a noise because that would be annoying.
Huh.
Well, you know all the things that happen on your phone. How many notification noises do you want to get? My phone, if everything that my phone wanted to tell me was constantly beeping, I would never get anything done.
That's true.
Last night, somebody said, well, I didn't send you a message to see when you were available because I thought you might be sleeping and I didn't want to wake you up.
Oh.
So this person lives in California, so they're 3 hours earlier, which is why they often are available when I'm not awake, because they come home late. I said, no, I actually, when I'm sleeping, don't let chat notifications come through to my phone. I turn those off. I only let certain urgent ones come through. So you can send me messages in the middle of the night. But it's the same sort of thing. And I'm sure everybody has tried to deal with this at some point, where you're sitting here saying, well, how do I tune my notifications so I get the important ones, but the non-important ones are somewhere where I could look at them? Because if I didn't want to know about those things, I would turn off the notifications entirely.
Sure.
So that's what I really want to do with my automations, which is I want the ones that are notifying me of things I need to know, like there is a leak in my kitchen sink, for example, which is one I'd want to know about immediately. I'm not sure. I can't remember if I told the story of what happened when I went to Florida in December with the flood. Did I tell you about that?
Probably, but I don't recall it.
Okay, I will summarize it in case I told the longer version of the story. I went to Florida for a bit in December, which you know because I recorded from there. And I finished work and then flew down in the evening, and the flight was delayed, so I didn't actually get into my parents' apartment there until 1 in the morning. Now, my parents were still in New York. They had closed up their apartment at the end of the previous season and come back to New York, so their apartment was sealed up. The hurricane shutters were on. They have a balcony. The balcony furniture was in the living room. So I came down a few days ahead of them because I had some extra vacation time, and I said, okay, I'll set up their apartment. I'll put food in their refrigerator. I'll straighten up a bit, and when they get here, they won't have to worry. And since I could spend a few days quietly somewhere where nobody would bother me, which I thought would be relaxing. So I get there at 1 in the morning in the middle of the week, and because I had still had a few days of work to go, I was going to work remotely there for the following morning at 8 a.m. So I come in there and the entire kitchen floor is flooded. Because after they left for the season, the leak sensor under their sink reported a leak and they sent somebody in to turn the water off. When they knew I was going down, they called the building engineer for the apartment building and said, could you go fix the leak under the sink before we get back? And I said, why don't you wait until I get there in case there's a problem? But my mother wanted to have the sink working for when I was there so that I wouldn't have to fill any water I needed in the bathroom,
Right.
which was nice of her, but again, it didn't quite work out. Apparently, the building engineer did not know what they were doing because I came in and the whole thing had flooded. But the question was, why didn't the water sensor tell us that it was flooding so we could send somebody in again? He moved it. So the water sensor is a little battery operated sensor. It was under the sink. He moved it to the counter so when he got in there and he didn't put it back. So the sensor being on the counter does not help in
That's true.
notifying somebody of a water leak under the counter. So that's one of those lessons that you shouldn't have to teach yourself, but it just paid out that way. But if that sensor went off, again, it happened a few months earlier, the sensor went off, I got a notification, and I set it up so my mother gets a notification because it's not my apartment. But since I set it up, I get one also. And she called somebody in the building who has her key for emergencies. They went there, they turned the water off before it got bad. And then systematically, while I was there, I bought another pack of water sensors, replaced all the batteries, and added some additional sensors just in case this happens again. So there's now two under the sink, one directly under and one further away, so nobody will necessarily move it.
That's funny.
They aren't that expensive. I use the Govee 433 megahertz wireless sensors because I have the 433 megahertz antenna that I use to pick up the weather sensors, which are also on that frequency. So it'll pick them up and transmit them. And Govee has a little Wi-Fi converter device where it will pick them up and send you emails as well if you want to use it. Hope they don't stop
Cool.
selling those sensors. They're really inexpensive and they have sales on them all the time. I hope they don't switch to Wi-Fi or something for those. Then I'll have to buy Zigbee sensors. Oh well. Anyway, so that's my sort of notification story. But you actually, which is a rarity for you sent a story specifically about and something called Zigbee Home.
Apparently, there is a board, a development board, much like an ESP32. However, it supports Matter and Zigbee and a bunch of stuff. And it's you can buy it from Mouser or DigiKey, and they're like less than 10 bucks a piece.
Yeah.
And you can configure this devices much like you would an ESP a home device.
yeah
A
which
YAML thing, upload it, and solder on your sensors or whatever, and bam, you've got a Zigbee device.
and I find that interesting. The only thing that stops me from doing that is I hate soldering.
Yes, you do need to solder.
Yeah, well.
But the boards are 10 bucks a piece.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And Mouser has like 11,000 of them in stock.
Yeah, but you notice what my solution is because you got a kick out of it, which is the those little atom ones that are already in the plastic case that have a little jack on it that you can attach a sensor that you can also buy from them that's reasonably inexpensive?
Yep. I'm currently waiting on a shipment now from them.
I'm tempted to do another shipment. Every time I look at their new product delivery, it's, should I buy more sensors? The two things that I keep saying I'm buying too many of, that I'm probably overloading my home and other places with, are like random ESP home sensors and mechanical keyboards. I do not know why I keep buying mechanical keyboards.
Because they're nice.
No, I'm saying why I only have one set of hands. Why do I need more than one keyboard? But I just, even though I had a Keychron C1, which is a hot swappable mechanical keyboard that I have never hot swapped, I just bought a C3, which is for $30, which is a budget keyboard, but it includes the QMK via firmware, open source firmware. So you can essentially dynamically remap the keys. And I discovered that the C1 doesn't have that, but the C1 Pro does. So had I spent a few more dollars, I could have gotten that. Or apparently you might be able to compile and put custom firmware on the C1, but I haven't had the patience to figure that out. So I figured for $30, I want to experiment with how would my productivity be if I was able to custom remap things and load them into the keyboard. That sounds like sort of an interesting thing to play with. So I'm field testing the C3 right now. And I do recommend it. It's not a bad keyboard for $30. It has your choice of, not changeable, but your choice of either red or brown switches when you order it. Red backlighting. I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of red, but you know, does it. And a pretty, for $30, a pretty reinforced thing. And again, open source firmware that apparently isn't usually available on such inexpensive keyboards. So, worth a shot if it's still on sale. Which it may be, I haven't looked. But if you try the Zigbee Home project, tell me how it goes. I'm curious about that.
Yes, sir.
A few other things. Hire. Hit a Home Assistant plugin developer with a takedown notice. And I noticed I put these stories out of order, so I'm just rearranging them in chronological order. So they issued a takedown notice for their integration for their smart control app for their appliances. So they do General Electric appliances, Hotpoint, Hoover, Fischl, and Paykel, Candy. And apparently the plugins that are in a GitHub repository that were developed by a German software developer apparently is what they tried to take down. So it allows you to integrate into their these products into Home Assistant. So they claimed that the plugins caused a significant financial damage and violated copyright laws. So obviously there's sort of a problem here, especially since a lot of people went online and said, I bought two appliances because they had Home Assistant integration, even though, again, it wasn't official. Why would you not let us do this when there are apparently 300,000 active Home Assistant users using this plugin?
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's sort of, well, why don't you work with the person? Apparently, the plugins have been forked 228 times.
And that's funny.
So there's more to this, because apparently this, it turned out that it was the, not necessarily the entirety of Hire, apparently it was the, that Hire Europe as a separately organized entity decided to go alone, where Hire itself in the U.S. apparently has distanced themselves from the issue.
Interesting.
So the official account for them has said that they're going to continue to support their open IoT platform and allow Home Assistant to be used. So apparently the brand in the U.S. and the brand in Europe are apparently operating separately.
Well, as a as a employee of a multinational company, does that surprise you?
No, but what it comes to is it's interesting because apparently the European division and the U.S. division use a different API platform.
Interesting.
So the plugin was apparently for the European platform, because it, I'm assuming that because it was a German developer. I didn't look to see do they support both versions. But apparently the U.S. One there is an open IT platform that does not prevent integrations with Home Assistant. And again, GE Appliances, which is, again, what Higher Appliance Division operates on, because I assume they spun off years ago, but they apparently have always offered a local control API. But apparently Home Assistant doesn't currently make use of it. But again, we're back to why not? Now, I don't necessarily feel like I need a smart refrigerator. I'm not saying it wouldn't be nice, but the benefit versus what I could actually do with it. I just put a battery-operated temperature sensor in the drawer in my refrigerator, and that's all I really need. What would you want? You know, the same thing. I wish that my laundry equipment would tell me when it was done, so I didn't have to go out there periodically and check, because it's not in my apartment. I don't have my own personal one. It's for the building. I wish it would notify me when it was done, so I didn't have to stand out there and wait.
We have LG refrigerators and LG washers and dryers.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of cool to see how many times the door to the refrigerator is opened on a day.
I'm sure you could rig something. I'm sure you could rig something up for a lot less than the premium on some of these refrigerators.
Yeah. But we still, it doesn't tell you the actual temperature inside. It tells you what the temperature is set to. So you still need a temperature sensor inside the freezer and the refrigerator.
And as I said, for a refrigerator, that's the only thing I need. For a washer and dryer, I just really want to know when the cycle's done. So I tried a bunch of things that people suggested online. I had essentially an energy monitoring plug connected up to the thing that would essentially detect when the washer was drawing energy. But the problem is that it would, like, in certain cycles, it would draw no energy.
Right.
So it made it really hard to figure out when the end of the cycle was. And then I had that smart dry thing that the company went under, and technically it's a Bluetooth device. So I had a ESP Home trying to pick it up, and I found somebody who wrote a little program to make an ESP Home binary sensor, and that doesn't quite work. I have to figure out why.
Have you considered a vibration sensor?
Tried that too. It doesn't vibrate enough.
Ah.
It wasn't picking it up, but I may try again with the smart dry, because without me hacking the smart dry to continue to work by having it essentially, since it's transmitting anyway, by having it picked up and interpreted by ESP Home, it essentially was a waste of money, because again, the company discontinued support for it. And again, that happens, but then there's the stove. Would you want a smart stove? Probably not.
Yeah.
One already. But no, it's like anything else. Sometimes I might want to know, you know, how many minutes there are on a timer, but there are much easier ways to do that a lot of the time. So I have not been motivated in some of those cases. If I'm setting a timer, I could just set a concurrent timer on my phone
to come back. Now, I could see a case for a smart oven, especially if it had a temperature sensor on a stick that you could shove into whatever you're cooking, and then
They have those, and I think, you know, things like the June oven, which does have a temperature probe, if I remember correctly. But the June oven, if you look at it, is essentially just a really smart toaster oven, which is, you know, it's sort of proportional to what it costs to get one of those things. It's back to, it would be cool to have, but the cost doesn't necessarily get justified. And notice, I just said I bought a nightlight that I thought was a little expensive for a nightlight. But
it was. It's like $20 for a night, or 20 or 30.
30. But I had they had a coupon, so it ended up being like 25. So some things, that would be interesting. I think I'll wait for the next time it's on sale.
And there's also a difference between something that is expensive, meaning it's like $10 more, and there's something that's expensive, which means it's like $1,000 more.
Yeah, and for me, appliances are one of those things where if I was buying a new appliance, I would look to see what the smart version, what the difference was, and decide on a cost-benefit basis, is that worth it? even though some of these things are nice to have. And sometimes I'd rather go with the sort of hacky solution. But sometimes doing it yourself is not as easy as buying something.
I understand. Yep.
So in a bit of sad news, the inventor of the NTP protocol has passed away.
Oh.
So this would be Dave Mills, who created NTP, which is the protocol that essentially keeps time on the internet to this day.
And responsible for many, many a DDoS.
Yeah, but remember, a lot of things that were built back in the 70s, in this case, no, the NTP is 85, but a lot of things that were built in the early days of technology didn't have the level of security until somebody realized that they could be exploited, and then they got the level of security.
Or that they would be exploited.
Well, you know, the computer world was very innocent early on.
That's true.
You know, it's because who would have thought that it would have ended up at this point?
I think it's not a surprise that it ended up where it did, but there's also value to, you know, we'll solve that problem when we run into it.
Yeah. And some things are about foresight and some things aren't. But NTP, again, it's still being used today. It, you know, obviously they've iterated on it. Obviously there have been, you know, technology improvements for security. And apparently there was a draft for a version 5 that includes essentially higher security than the current versions.
Right.
But again, I don't think that it actually has gone very far, last I saw. And Mills himself apparently retired and turned it over to other people some years ago.
Well, he invented an incredibly important thing.
And that's why you notice whenever these stories come out about, you know, the early pioneers of technology, I always like to sort of highlight it.
Yes. It's good to remember the shoulders upon which we stand.
I'm waiting for the movie, though. Probably won't be a very interesting one. I don't know how you could make, you know, a drama and suspense out of the story of the NTP protocol. If you're a user of Plex, which I am, apparently they will let you rent and buy movies and TV shows starting next month.
Crazy.
Well, I'm worried about Plex. It makes me think I should since my actual files are stored on a NAS, I could run two media server programs in parallel if I wanted to. I considered trying out Jellyfin. And the reason for that is a few things about Plex that worry me.
Yeah.
First of all, they laid off 20% of their staff in June. That's not necessarily... I'm not going to say it isn't a bad thing. I'm saying it's not necessarily an indication of that there's going to be further crisis. But essentially, the fact that they're pivoting to streaming, that now they have a live TV streaming thing that they're doing, now they're doing buying and renting movies, that they aren't actually profitable, and that they're trying to make their revenue from ads, despite the fact that I have paid the money for a subscription. They're also doing all these really annoying social tools that I don't use. And yep. I think there's a lot of people, and I looked online, who are saying, wait a minute, we're here because we want to play our local media. And the company that we essentially bought software from, or in the case of Plex, bought a subscription to in order to support, is saying they can't make money with our subscriptions. They are pivoting away from local media and they want to be like everybody else and do streaming. So why don't we start looking for a product that actually cares about people who want to do local media? So to be honest, there's a lot of things about Jellyfin, if you look at the features, that don't match what Plex has. So I hope, even if Plex is going to do this sort of on-demand streaming and live free channels over the internet, that they still keep the local media server product that they're that the people who are enthusiasts of their software actually care about. Because you know what happens when you alienate the enthusiasts.
They go away.
Yes, and those are your loyal people.
And they're the ones who introduced it to everybody else.
Yeah, but it's also the thing of, being a watcher of local media as opposed to streaming is a niche. But there are plenty of people who have made a good living off of serving people in a niche, in a narrow segment of society. So we'll see what happens. But again, it worries me that they're essentially burying the product that they originally were in favor of a new product. That the question is, do people want that product? Do we need another advertiser supported streaming service? Don't we have enough of those and they're not making enough money?
Yeah.
Although an interesting note, I found out that somebody who works for my employer wrote a movie that's on Tubi. I was trying to decide if I should watch it and support. Of course, then I'd have to find out how to watch something on Tubi. But have you ever watched anything on Tubi?
I've never even heard of it.
It's a thing. I've heard of it. That's the extent of my knowledge of Tubi. But anyway, the FCC has proposed new rules to protect consumers against cable and streaming blackouts. So the rules that they seem to be proposing is essentially you shouldn't have to ask if a company doesn't provide a service due to a contractual issue with one of their sub-providers. In this case, let's say they stop carrying a channel. They shouldn't have to call and say, I deserve credit. They should be required to be given a credit. I could get behind that.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that I believe that the government should do it or not do it. I can get behind the idea that if you are no longer providing me with a service that I am paying you for because you are in a disagreement with the provider, then why should I be paying you for the service? I will agree with that in principle. I know it's not that simple.
Yep.
But there we are, especially since, again, I'll even quote the Cord Cutters article. There have been 83 blackouts due to disagreements between DirecTV, Nexstar, Spectrum, Disney, DirecTV, and Tegna. So essentially, if you're expected to pay the full price for services that are not being delivered, why shouldn't you be required to actually credit your customers if you want to fight with your subcontractors? Why bring all your customers into it? Anyway, that said, the other thing would be the consumer labels for broadband services, the all-in pricing information, which is requiring that promotional materials and bills actually explain what you're paying so that you don't feel like you need a calculator and a degree to figure out what your bill is.
That's understand funny. It.
And to limit junk fees. So junk fees, again, would be fees for essentially doing things that should not have a fee charged. So the idea is that a fee on there should be for a very clear service that is provided. Which I'll agree with. You shouldn't just charge people things just because you can. There should be a reason. You should have to actually justify why you were charging somebody a fee to do something. For example, if you sign a contract that says you're willing to pay for something for 2 years and you leave early, an early termination fee is somewhat fair. Now, there should be exceptions to that. For example, if the company stops providing you service, then they violated their end of the contract, in which case you should be able to terminate without charge. So there are some fairness and other related issues there. Moving along, back to Home Assistant. Home Assistant has introduced their voice assistant contest.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I think I mentioned this a bit last week, but I didn't get a chance to look at it until this week. So I knew it was happening. But are you going to submit anything?
No.
No? You don't want to win a Home Assistant Green or a Sky Connect?
I have a Sky Connect, and I don't use it. And no, I don't need a Green.
Okay, well, I'm interested to see what creative people come up with. If I really thought I had a creative idea, I would, but I'm not going to try to think of a creative idea just to win a contest.
Sure.
So I'm looking forward to watching what other people do that's creative. Shelly, remember Shelly? They are yes. They make smart home devices that are essentially very popular. I've never owned a Shelly device. They always look good, but they don't exactly fit my niche.
They tend to be big.
Well, their relays are really popular and fairly reliable, but I haven't needed a relay. Now they do have some other ones.
Also designed for, the form factor is for like UK based, big old honking boxes.
No, I agree with you, but they've pivoted a bit. They've introduced some US specific versions of their products. They're trying to essentially attract a different market by having different versions.
You see the Shelly Mini Gen 3s? They're like the size of a quarter.
That's what I'm saying. They're trying to. They've realized that what they have doesn't quite work for all markets, so they are trying to address that. And they are. They did do a few U.S. specifics things, but also if they can get the regular one down, so that they don't have to do that, that saves them a lot of money, doesn't it?
Yep.
I've watched a lot of Shark Tank. Isn't there a whole thing where they're always talking about SKUs and how many different SKUs people should have, and how it adds complexity to your business?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I just watch Shark Tank to watch people pitch really ridiculous things that for some reason billionaires pay money for. But it doesn't make sense to me. I'm going to pay a lot of money to buy a company that makes really ugly sweaters. I hope their mission statement is to make ugly sweaters, not that they make them by accident. Anyway, I don't quite get finance. That's probably why I'm not a rich person. Anyway, back to Shelly. Their new climate sensor essentially is added matter. So this is their Shelly H&T Generation 3. And I've been watching their humidity and temperature, which is the H&T sensor, since the original version. But the new one has an e-paper display, can run up to a year on a battery, and supports matter.
Or AA batteries.
Well, on a single replacement battery. I know it's not literally a single battery.
But it's also not tiny batteries. But it's a display. It's got RAM.
Yeah, so even though I could build my own sensors, the one thing that I've never done is built one that has a display that actually shows the reading.
Right.
Now, I've tried that. So I have the Atom S3 with the LCD display. And I was having a little trouble getting that to do anything under under ESP Home. I got it to display, and then I got a message that the component that was being used was being deprecated. In the next version, I need to use this other component. And after about, about an hour of fiddling with it, I decided that I would try another time. But if you've seen those, you've seen the size of an Atom, the M5 stack Atoms. It's the same size, except it's a little thicker because it has a little screen. But the screen is, again, like essentially that tiny. But how much screen do you need? A small resolution is perfectly fine if all you want to do is the text of what your sensors say, reading out on the screen. So if I get it working, I would buy more of these little ones with the screens in it. I only bought two of them to play with. But the Shelly thing, again, it has the time, it has the temperature, it has the humidity, and of course it has a reading of the battery. And I'm assuming that it's running an ESP chip because I also see that it has Bluetooth.
Yep.
So, again, nice little device. I think I could do something that work with this. And if anybody has any suggestions about little inexpensive LCD screens that could show readings from sensors that could run with ESP Home quickly. That's the thing that shocks me about ESP Home. You would think that the configuration, even though it's incredibly powerful, would have a really easy way to do what I just mentioned. But oddly enough, there's actually a lot more steps to getting an LCD screen to read out stuff than you'd think.
Sure, I imagine. I mean, configuring a display from...
Yeah. No, I'm saying... I'm surprised that they didn't put in, a couple of like quick configuration commands to make it easier to just quickly do. But again, I like advanced stuff where I can essentially go even further. But I'm surprised I can't just say treat the LCD screen like a character display, instead of having to essentially design how the have everything is drawn and the font and everything, I should be able to do a simple way of it. But I will learn all of those other things at some point and get it working. And I gave you an iOS story because I know you are a fan of the Apple ecosystem.
Yay!
Apparently, iOS apps can now offer external payment links, but apparently it is not very appealing to do it. So you have to follow a very strict set of guidelines and then submit a request to Apple to allow the approval of the external payment link, wait for the request to be approved, and then you can add it. So you can add third-party payment in addition to App Store payment, but not as a replacement. So anytime you are selling anything, you have to offer App Store payment as an option. You can only include a single link to an external site for payment, shown on a single page that's in a dedicated persistent location in the app, and it cannot be shown anywhere else or in a pop-up modal or interstitial window. So essentially, they are letting you do it, but you have to hide it. You can't even put it on the page when you go to pay for something that it'll say, would you like to pay here or would you like to pay there? The page cannot be the same as the in-app purchase screen, so essentially it has to be totally separate and isolated. It cannot mimic the purchase system or discourage users from using it. So essentially you can't say, please use our payment system because we don't have to give Apple 30% if you do. Is it 30 now? I forget what the word.
Something like, I think it's always been 30.
Yeah. No, I'm saying I haven't looked recently. The external purchase link must open a new window in the user's default web browser. You cannot use a web view to show the page in the app itself. You can't include any information about external purchase options in the product page in the App Store for their apps or games. So you can't tell anybody before they download the app that you could actually pay any other way. And wow. The API will show a disclosure sheet when you click a link to external payment, letting them know that they're about to go to an external site and Apple is not responsible for the privacy or security of purchases made on the web.
Says, if you go here, you'll get cancer.
Well, at least one person, the CEO of Epic, has said that this is a scare screen meant to put users off from trusting third-party purchase links, even though the information on there is technically true.
Yep.
Which is, they can't be responsible for what happens for purchases on the web.
That's true.
The other complaints would be by requiring users to pay through an external browser, they have to sign into the same app or service twice, once in the app and again in the browser. And even better, apparently you don't actually get to save money by doing alternate payment methods because while they take 30% of in-app purchases or subscriptions through the App Store, apparently they also want a cut of purchases made through an external website.
Sure they do.
So they're required to pay Apple a 27% commission on all sales made after the users click a link to an external payment source. And once you factor in credit card processing fees, that might actually be more. Apple charges, here we are, developers 30% for 12-month subscriptions for the first year and 15% for the following year. But if they offer outside of the App Store, they have to pay Apple a 27% commission and 12% for the following year.
And this is why you cannot buy Audible app or Audible books from inside the Amazon store.
Yeah, apparently Epic has said that they plan to contest Apple's bad faith compliance. So essentially, they were required to do this in order to comply with a previous legal case. And apparently Epic, who filed that case, has said that they intend to contest the fact that this is not really what the intent of the court order was. That they have opened it up. They've made it so that why would anybody want to do this? Because they've made it so onerous and inappropriate for anybody to do it. Now, to be fair to Apple, and I don't say that very often, they do have the right to get something for providing services. However, if the payment processing is being done outside of their system, what are they actually doing? Especially since, you know, they could charge people for listing in the App Store if they really wanted to. If they don't use their payment system, they could say, well, you have to pay for the infrastructure. I'm not saying I'm suggesting that. I'm saying at least that would be a consistent thought. But they're saying, well, we get 27% of what you make, but we didn't do anything. We just essentially sold the hardware to the customer, which we've been paid for. So I don't know. So if they wanted to say that if you use an alternate processing system, you have to pay some fixed costs, fine. I don't know. Anyway, thus is life.
Yes, it is.
So we are coming to the end of our program for this week.
Are
you interested in doing the same thing next week?
I would like that. I like that plan. That's a good plan.
Yes, next week is an exciting day for me.
Is it?
The 31st. I have a packed day. It's the day of my annual physical. That's always exciting. That's where my doctor yells at me for why I'm not in better health.
Okay.
He's a very cranky individual. He's told me that the only way that he's going to stop being my doctor is if they drag him out of the office on a gurney. He doesn't intend to retire until his body forces him to.
All right. Then yes, let's do it that day.
Yeah, I'll be in a better mood after that. Oddly. Anyway, so that brings us to the end of this week. If you think of anything you'd like to share with us, please send us a note. I am always happy to hear from people. And hopefully I will have news of additional and interesting projects that I am pursuing. Jerry, hopefully you'll have the same. Not saying that your projects are not interesting. I'm just saying we always hope that we have something to talk about. Otherwise, what are we doing here?
Yep. All right. Then I will say good night, folks.
Good night, and have a nice week.